All right, we're continuing our study of the life of Solomon. And so if you would turn in your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 4. And we have to some degree a summary of his rule. Just some facts and figures. And it seems to be sort of a jumble of things, but there is a purpose for all this. First of all, it lists his officials, and we hit on this a little bit, and I'm not going to read through all the difficult to pronounce names. We have his administration in Jerusalem, and that's the first six verses or so. Mentioned also that two of the sons of Nathan are among those listed, and there's some things we can deduce from that that ties in well with certain things that are in Jewish tradition, that Solomon had a close relationship with Nathan the prophet. Nathan is the one that named him Jedidiah, beloved of the Lord. And there was apparently a close relationship. I would suggest that Nathan's two sons probably grew up with Solomon, and they spent a considerable amount of time together, godly young men that he put into his administration in high places. One was chief of staff, and the other one was what is called the king's friend, a personal counselor, someone that the king can bounce ideas off of and that sort of thing. And so he had that. And then there were those that that levied foodstuffs for the king's household. There's a long list there. That goes from verse 6 through 19. And if you look at the places and stuff there on a map, and you can probably go online and actually find a map of this. They have maps for everything. It's not quite the same as the tribal allotments. And it has to do with the fact that he was divvying it up so that it was not a huge burden on any particular place more than another. If you have a piece of ground that is less productive, then you want more acreage. And if you have a place that is particularly productive, then it could be smaller. And some of the tribes had neither. And so combine it with something else. The foodstuffs that are listed here are just amazing. So let's drop down to after we've gotten through those lists, all right? I'm gonna jump over that. But the idea here also, as much as we look at a top-heavy government, and we complain about that here in the States, but understand that every country that has some measure of continuity without interruptions, the administration, the bureaucrats, there we go, the number of those just slowly builds over time. If you look at the White House staff today, they are not just in the White House, they're in multiple buildings all over the place. And yet during World War II, FDR's White House staff was 400 to 500 people during the war. And that's without computers. Makes you wonder why they need thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And the reality is they don't really. But I will also let you know this. They do need a lot of people. Granted, we complain about the overextension, but you need a lot of people to run a big operation. You need the right people. You need people with thoughts and ideas, people that are dependable, people that can delegate, people that are responsible. And so one of the reasons we have these lists is to show you that even from the beginning, Solomon would pick the best people. And as you go, if you were to read through the thing, it mentions that Solomon noted that somebody was industrious and he took him and made him this responsible over here. He's handpicking his people. He's got his eyes opened to those who are capable and he's going to put them in different places. How many of you have ever read a book on the Lincoln administration called Team of Rivals? Anybody here read that book? My good one. It's a fascinating book. The Lincoln administration was made up of a bunch of people that hated each other. It was made up of a bunch of AAA type personalities that were in serious competition with each other. When Lincoln ran for the presidency, you had, as it is this year, for the governorship of this state, you had a bunch of people running. And they were all vying for one another, and it got down to like the final 8 or 10, and then it went to the convention, and Lincoln, by an odd set of circumstances, was actually became the nominee, even though he wasn't expected to be. And so when Lincoln ended up winning the election, what Lincoln did is he took the guys that were running against him and made them into his cabinet, because they were the most qualified. Plus, he can keep an eye on them, but but they were the most qualified. The guy who was Secretary of the Treasury was Salmon P. Chase. You familiar with Chase Bank? Okay, named after him. If you were to reach into your wallet and pull out a $100,000 bill, that's his picture on it. Take a look. Go ahead. Take a look. He was the guy that financed, worked out the finances and everything, so they could pay for the Civil War. And he had a number of people like that that were top-notch people, because even though they wanted his job, even though they were competing with him, he hired them because they were the very best. Now, Solomon was not necessarily worried about, he's a king. You know, it's not an election. And so, he's a smart guy, but he also knows he can't do it all. And so he's going to delegate things, and he is going to have the very best of the best. And that's one of the reasons you have that list there, is to show you that he had a fantastic, very competent administration, so that the kingdom, although there was a lot of people involved, was extremely well run. He is going to make sure that he has the best of the best as far as the administration is concerned. And so here's the, you know, it's kind of funny. I'm going, how am I going to picture a council, a cabinet? Because if I do anything, if I go to the White House, I'm gonna make some people uptight. Unless I get a really, really old picture. So this is the, this is from, about 140 years ago in England. Okay, so this is the cabinet when Queen Victoria was Queen of England. So you have a bunch of really smart guys who all want the Prime Minister's job. But they're there because they're really good at what they're doing. And Solomon had all these fantastic people in those positions of leadership, so to make sure that the job was done and done well. Because again, even though Solomon is wise, he can't do it all himself. You've got to delegate. You've got to delegate. And that goes down through verse 19. It says in verse 20, "And Judah and Israel were many as the sand which is by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and making merry." And it says, "Every man under his vine and under his fig tree," in another passage. You're dealing with a multiplication of people. You're dealing with great prosperity. How can you pull off a multiplication of people and great prosperity 3,000 years ago? All right. Here, somebody picking figs. All right. How can you, by the way, that reminds me, I need to go pick figs. But how could this be pulled off 3,000 years ago as far as wealth, prosperity, and above all, peace? Because peace is the key. Throughout most of human history, you would have invaders. Might be a generation or two or three, but your country invariably would be invaded and overrun by somebody else. You might be able to beat them off, but the land would be ravaged, people would be impoverished, the crops destroyed, buildings burned, and people killed and so forth. During Solomon's reign of 40 years, there were no wars. During Solomon's reign, prosperity. And understand that in ancient Israel, when you had your property, if you're an Israelite, your property could not be sold permanently. You could sell it, but during the year of Jubilee, every 50 years, it reverted back to the original owners, and if they'd passed away, to his heirs. So the ground stayed in the family for centuries. What Joshua had distributed to the people during the conquest was still, for the most part, in the same families when we get to Solomon. And you can imagine what you could do if you were industrious, if you had a vision of what you'd like to do. And you could have orchard. You remember, it's an agricultural society. You could have orchards, you could have vineyards, you could have fields of grain, you could have your barns, and you could rearrange things, and you don't have to worry about invaders coming in and destroying your crops and pillaging things, or having a corrupt administration that'll seize it from you. You had peace and prosperity under the reign of Solomon. And also, when you don't have war, it allows for an opportunity for the people to multiply. War in our generation, and we've had war in our generation, but the men who have died in the last 25 years in the wars of the United States, undeclared wars for the most part, all entirely, but we had more men die on days in World War II than have died in combat in the last 25 years, total. War used to involve the annihilation of tens of thousands of men in a day or two. In World War I, you would have a bombardment that would, with mortars and so on, that would, explosive mortars that would last for 5-6 hours. So that an area of, 12 square miles is bomb craters on top of bomb craters on top of bomb craters, and that's all it is a mass of bomb craters. You obliterated everything and everybody that was in that. And then, after you've done that to clear the path, you'd send your troops in. We're going to send 25,000 men across this no man's land to invade the trenches that are on the other side where the enemy is still ensconced. And the guys in the trenches over there are waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And then they bring out their machine guns and rifles and they blow away a third of the troops. And then they run back. This is one of the reasons why for 3 years the line in World War I basically didn't change. It just took Terrans killing each other and bombarding each other. And you had a shift back and forth. When we deal with how many men died in World War I, we're dealing with percentages of the population, of like 5 and 6% of the male population of certain countries. It's crazy. People died in huge numbers. And that was standard operating procedure in most of human history. When you had wars, it was a matter of how many, if you had enough people to overwhelm the other guy. Israel had peace and prosperity for over 40 years. No wars. And therefore the people were able to multiply. They were able to devote themselves to agriculture and prosperity. And that's what happened during the time of Solomon. So general prosperity. Verse 24. For he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river. When you have the river in your Old Testament, it's talking about the Euphrates. And so he ruled from the Euphrates to, and it mentions two little places, Tifsa, even to Azza, even over all the kings on this side of the river, and he had peace on all sides round about. There was no wars or conflicts. He had, it was a peace with everybody that around him. And his empire is everything in red, blue, and green. For those of you who have, I don't think I've got a pointer. All right, I'll come over here and do this, all right? This is modern Israel. This is Lebanon. This is modern Jordan. This is modern Syria, going all the way up to there. And then once we get over, down over in here, it becomes Saudi Arabia and up there, Iraq. And so he controlled all of what is now Israel, portions of what are now Lebanon, portions of all of what is now Jordan, all of what is now Syria, and little bits of a few other places. He had a huge empire. And there was no war. He maintained this by trade and trade agreements, and here's where we get into problems. Marriages of alliance. Even though it doesn't mention that here, it'll come in later on. So he had this fantastic, huge empire, prosperity, no war. This is very, very unusual in ancient times. It's not that common today. But this was very, very unusual in ancient times. No wonder there was enormous prosperity. Part of the reason was he's a smart guy and he knows how to work it and how to do this. Give you a little clue, and this happens today more than we'd probably want to admit. The Persians, the ancient Persians, the fellows who conquered Babylon, the people who were ruling the roost when Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther were around. Okay, the Persians. The Persians had a gigantic empire that went from Pakistan to Libya. Just a gigantic, huge, biggest empire that had existed up to that point in time. Gigantic. How did they maintain it? Different empires throughout history have maintained their empires because you're dealing with all kinds of ethnic groups and languages and everything else, very diverse people who all have their own game, goals and objectives and so on. How do you maintain the integrity of an empire? You can do it several different ways. The Assyrians did it by terror. Okay, the Nazis did it the same way for the most part. They do it by terror. Oh, you killed one of our soldiers? All right, we're going to randomly pick 25 people out of your village and hang them. So don't do it again. That's what the Nazis did. And the Assyrians did similar things. Sometimes you do it by what the Romans did. They did it twofold. Hey, doesn't matter where in the empire you are, you can become a citizen of the empire. You know what side of the bread is buttered, you know. Pay some money, become a citizen. They give you some special perks and privileges, and it doesn't matter where you're from, what ethnic group you are, what language you speak, you can become a citizen. Or you can do it also what the Romans did. The emperor is God, and we're all going to worship the same God. So we're all going to worship the emperor. And by the way, that's what the Antichrist is going to do. And that's actually been a very... That's how the Egyptians maintain control to some extent as well. The Pharaoh is God. Another way you can do it is what the Persians did to a large degree. Money. All right? If I have a region where there's an uprising, and this particular chieftain over here is the guy who's raising up the troops, and he's wanting to overthrow my authority in this part of my empire and establish himself as the power there. What I can do is I can send an ambassador over there and tell this chieftain this. I'll tell you what. If you just sort of stop this, I'll make you governor. And I'll make you wealthier than you have ever dreamed. And the guy would go, okay. And that's how the Persians maintained control in a lot of their places. Money talks, does today. And I think that Solomon, to some extent, was able to maintain his empire because of trade agreements and so on. It was in everybody's interest to make sure that the peace was maintained because, hey, everybody is benefiting financially. And that's part of what holds the world together today, because everybody has been benefiting financially since World War II, especially since the end of the Cold War. And so even though it's pretty shaky sometimes, everybody's benefiting, so we're not going to let it get too far out of control, because otherwise we're going to be killing the golden goose. So we'll work this all out, even though we hate each other, because after all, if we mess this up, then we're all going to suffer. So we'll let it calm down. That's what's holding the world together today to some extent. And that's what it was to a degree here. Provisions for his household. This is incredible. This is incredible. The list that is here is amazing. Look in verse 22 of chapter 4. And Solomon's provision for one day. Tomorrow is grocery shopping day at my house. And that's my date day with my wife. We go to Costco, we go to Fred Meyer, and we go to lunch. Woohoo! Get to hang out with my sweetie. and doing something that we have to do anyway, so might as well do it together. And but we're buying stuff for a week, and I still have two grown kids at home that are paying rent because of the cost of housing around here. And so it's amazing. When David was out of town for 2 weeks and my grocery bill was cut in half. It's absolutely amazing. Although we're having, what are we having, ribeyes when we get home? That he bought. Because, you know, it's kind of funny. When you work at Fred Meyer, like he does, when he has his break, you know, different, some people go to the clothing department, some people go to the tech and they look at the latest phones and stuff like that. David goes to the meat department and scans and checks out the meat department. One day for Solomon, verse 22, the provision for one day, 30 measures of fine flour and 70 measures of wheat. I have in your outline, that means 300 bushels of flour, 600 bushels of meal, one day. With that, now we had a pita bread that I broke here this morning. There's some pita bread from the Middle East there. For a standard loaf of bread, using this amount of flour and meal, you could make 81,000 loaves of bread. In one day. 81,000 loaves of bread. One day. Verse 23. He likes his barbecue. Today was supposed to have been the church barbecue day. Maybe we'll do it for Thanksgiving. We'll see. 10 fat oxen, in other words, grain-fed in the stall. 10 of those, plus 20 oxen out of the pastures, your grass-fed variety. 30 oxen per day. Per day. And 100 sheep per day. All right? So, 30 of these... 30 of these. Now, granted, they were a little smaller back in Solomon's day. But still, a dressed cow back in Solomon's day probably weighed in 300-400 pounds. Sheep. 100 of these a day. I'd like to hang out with Solomon, I would. Plus... harts, that would be deer, and roebucks, that's another kind of deer, and fallow deer, that's obviously another kind of deer, and fatted fowl, geese, chickens, they did have those. So, all those cattle, all those sheep, plus wild game, plus poultry, all one day. So my vision, as I envisioned Solomon, I used to think of this tall, lanky guy with a long beard. Now I'm thinking of Solomon. Be aware that we have this long list at the beginning of the chapter of his administration. And those are just the officers. That doesn't include all the people that are the runners and the secretaries and the people out that are making sure that the job gets done and so on. So we deal with not just a few dozen, we're dealing with thousands of people. Different people have calculated that all the food that is described here would feed 4,000 to 5,000 people. Which, frankly, is actually pretty reasonable when you think about it. Good grief, where could they... Somebody else has calculated how much ground it would take to... Because all those, so those officers, each section of the country was required to feed the household for a month per year. It was on a rotation. How much ground do you have to devote to growing grain and so on to be able to produce that much flour to be able to feed all those people. It's not as much as you might think. It's a little over 400 acres, less than a square mile. So, square mile's not, I mean, that's a lot. I don't own a square mile. But, you know what? Square mile, if you were to back out and look at a Google map of just Pierce County and then block out one square mile, you might miss it. Alright? So, even though this is a lot of stuff, it's not really an undue burden on the country to support that number of people. At least not as far as the food was concerned. It mentions the size of the empire again in verse 24, the extent of his rule, the provision for his household, and then drop down to verse 26. And Solomon had 40,000 stalls for horses, for his chariots, and 12,000 horsemen. The guy liked horses. He had cavalry. Now, I want you to keep your finger here, and I want you to go to Deuteronomy chapter 17. As we look at the glory of Solomon, woven in with everything else is his subtle, not so subtle acts of disobedience. Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 16. It's talking about the choice of a king. It says in verse 16, he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to the end that they should multiply horses. By the way, Solomon did that. He imported them from Egypt and so forth. To the end that he should multiply horses, for as much as the Lord hath said unto you, he shall henceforth return no more that way. And then look at verse 17. This is going to be coming up here in the next couple of weeks as we look at his life. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart should turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. He did all these things. Because after all, that's what's expected of a king. Yeah, but God says this. Yeah, but. So he has this great cavalry. If you go to the ruins of the city of Megiddo today, which was one of his chariot cities, they have actually unearthed some of the stuff that indicates that there was actually a huge cavalry post in the city of Megiddo. There's stone water troughs and everything else for the horses that would have been there. Business. How do you pay for all this? Well, you can tax people. We know that toward the end, especially, Solomon had an oppressive tax burden, and the people wanted that taken care of. But he also was a fantastic businessman. I want you to go to chapter 9. If I have a business, a good business, I'm making a lot of stuff, I'm selling a lot of stuff, I've got a great widget business. Now, as I make my widgets, I've got a factory over here that's making the widgets, but I've got to get my raw materials from someplace. And also, I've heard that over here, the craftsmen over there are better at making widgets than my guys over here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have my guys over here package them and ship them out, but I'm going to have the folks over here make the widgets. We do that all kinds of, you know, how much of our stuff. I bought some pens this past, a little package of pens. You know, on a little blister board thing, you know, this little cardboard thing with plastic on front, hold them there. Package of pens. On the back, it says, made in
China.
Malaysia, packaged in Mexico. So, there's a factory making pens. They load them into a shipping container, ship them to Mexico. In Mexico, they've got a machine that runs them through there, and they put them on their blister board, and then they pack them into a container again and ship them to the States. Not they just make them here. Well, because it's cheaper to do it the other way. 3,000 years ago, okay, we still send stuff by ship Lots and lots and lots of stuff by ship. Okay, you go over here, go down the Puyallup River, and we've got the Port of Tacoma. Those are all great big cranes and everything. And you watch the trains go by here, over here, on the tracks. A lot of this stuff is containers that came over on a ship and then loaded on a rail car and then off to who knows where. And they put them on the backs of trucks and so forth. In ancient times, you didn't have the volume, anywhere near the volume that you have today. But there were certain goods that you just couldn't get in Israel. And you could get some exotic and weird stuff by ship. And Solomon, let's go back to our map. All right. You'll see that Phoenicia is not part of Solomon's empire. Okay, here's Tyre, here's Sidon. Byblos, which is where we get our word Bible from. That's where they did the paper and stuff. The Phoenicians were a seafaring people. And they're also the ones, the mountains here, is where the cedar of Lebanon grows. And they would provide, as we're going to look at that next time, the craftsmen and the raw materials for the temple. They would cut down the trees, bring them down in floats, bring them down here to Joppa, and then bring them up to Jerusalem. Solomon, because he needed their services, made an agreement with the Phoenicians and therefore did not incorporate them into his empire. And since he's dealing with a largely agricultural society, remember, every man under his vine, under his fig tree, and so forth, he would trade foodstuffs to the Phoenicians in exchange for raw materials, shipping, craftsmen, and so forth. Again, business deals. And so he put together a shipping fleet in conjunction with the Phoenicians. And he brought in all kinds of weird stuff, weird for the day, because you couldn't just run down to the store and get it. So again, chapter 9, and let's look in verses, beginning at verse 26. And Solomon made a navy of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is beside Eloth on the shore of the Red Sea. Right here. Today, it's called Eilat. Names don't change too much. And it's a tourist town. If you want to go to a really warm, hot, sunny beach in Israel, that's where you go. Because the Red Sea is much warmer than the Mediterranean. And he had a fleet there. He had a navy there that was built by and manned by the Phoenicians. Now, 3,000 years ago, this, by the way, goes way down. Was this little piece of water connected to this piece of water? It is if you want to sail all the way around Africa. Now today we have the Suez Canal, but in ancient times, even though they're not that far apart, you can't get there from here. Okay? So if I've got ships along here, I can go to Italy, I can go to Spain, I can go wherever, and they did. But I've got ships here. What? By the way, there's nothing down here except rocks. It's hot and dry. Why would I have a fleet there? Because that gives me access to other things. That's the Red Sea. Red Sea's long cigar-shaped thing at the bottom is where it pinches close to where Africa and Arabia come together. And then you go around Arabia and sail east. And what's east of there? India. And beyond India, China and the East Indies and so on. And you can come back with spices and you can come back with all kinds of weird stuff. Come back with ivory and ebony. Both those come from India. Different things, by the way. Up until probably 150 years ago, if you wanted emeralds, rubies, and diamonds, where did they come from? Up until about 150 years ago. They came from India. They hadn't discovered diamonds in South Africa yet. And so all your precious stones, almost all your precious stones came from India and Burma and Thailand. And Solomon had these things. Where did he get them? From that fleet. They brought back gold and they brought back all kinds of things. And then the fleet that went out to the west here in the Mediterranean went all the way to Tarshish. You know, where Jonah would later take off and go to? Where's Tarshish? Probably. Anybody know? Spain. When he went to Spain, he picked up all kinds of weird stuff there too that wasn't available in Israel. The one fleet, it says in verse 28, and they went to Ophir and fetched from thence gold, 420 talents, and brought it to Solomon. How much is a talent? I know it varies a little bit. How much is a talent? 75 to 100 pounds. So this ship came back with a lot of gold, tons of gold. Which, if you've got lots of gold, and somebody's bringing you, you know, pots and pans and beads, you can buy Manhattan, you know? Because they got something you can't get, and you want it. When he sailed west in the Mediterranean, it says they brought back, in the King James it says peacocks. Peacocks would be the other way, but the word peacocks doesn't occur other places in the scripture. It's probably guinea fowl, which they would have gotten in Morocco and so on. And it says also apes or monkeys. Do you know they have monkeys in Morocco? You know they have monkeys in Gibraltar? Anybody familiar with this? The Barbary apes? Monkeys? There's an old tradition that as long as there are monkeys at Gibraltar, it will remain a British possession. The British to this day have an officer whose sole duty is to make sure that the monkeys are in good shape. And there are monkeys that live on Gibraltar, which is the southern tip of the Iberian Peninsula. It's not Spanish territory, it's British territory and has been for hundreds of years. There are monkeys there. And in ancient times, there were probably monkeys in the south of Spain. And there are still monkeys in Morocco and Algeria. They're all the same kind. And so, but there aren't any monkeys anywhere in Israel or anywhere nearby. The nearest ones are baboons, and you don't want to have baboons. And they're way down in the southern tip of Arabia and Ethiopia. And so they would go and they'd bring back guinea fowl and silver and gold and fancy woods and stuff. And hey, we brought back, I remember that we had this as a toy when I was a kid, a barrel of monkeys. Because after all, we need to have monkeys. We need to have something weird and odd because I'm a king and I've got to have something really weird to show off. Hey, here's my monkeys. I don't know what else you could do with them except, hey, look at my monkeys. So he had a lot of stuff brought in by sea. In 1 Kings chapter 9 and verse 17, it says he built Gezer and Beth-horon the Nether. These are cities way up here, and this was the caravan route, the overland caravan routes that would, come from India and Afghanistan and so on, where you could get certain precious stones and other things that you couldn't get other places. Stuff that was carved into signets and so on, very valuable stuff. Now, it isn't like Solomon is saying, okay, give me more, I just need more toys. No, he's bringing this stuff in and then selling it to everybody else. He's making money hand over fist. By caravan, by ship, and then also in chapter 10, verses 28 and 29. And Solomon had horses brought out of Egypt and linen yarn. And the king's merchants received the linen yarn at a price. And a chariot came up and went out of Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. Probably a pretty good price. Wholesale, you know. And so for all the kings of the Hittites, that would be the folks up in Turkey, and for the kings of Syria, did they bring them out by their means. So Solomon is acting as a middleman. He's buying stuff down here in Egypt and selling it to the guys that are way up there by the ceiling. Because, hey, it's desert out here, and if you're going to bring stuff that you can't bring by ship, you got to go through here. So he controlled all the trade in between. And he made a lot of money doing it. Again, we're dealing with his prosperity, his magnificence, his greatness. And then his wisdom. Back to chapter 4. Verse 29. And let's get back up here past the sheep and goodies. And here's a ship. That's, that'd be like a, what a Phoenician ship would look like. They had, both ends, they have a figurehead there on the front, but both ends were pointed on the ancient ships, like a canoe. They didn't have a squared off stern in the ancient ships, and that was true with the Romans as well. And the caravans, they still use caravans in places. This is not for a movie set, this is actually a caravan. Verse 29. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much. And largeness of heart, the idea, remember, is not, he's not talking about generosity there. The idea of heart is also the seat of intellect and so on as far as the Jewish understanding is concerned. Even as the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite. By the way, we see him mentioned at the end of, I believe, the book of Proverbs, as well as one of the Psalms. And Heman and Karkol and Darda and the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all nations round about. So the people that were considered the great sages of the time, and maybe the not so distant past and so on, people whose writings were respected, people that their sayings and so on were revered. Solomon is greater than all those that were in his day and in the days before and, frankly, in the days to follow. It says he spake 3,000 proverbs. The book of Proverbs is from Solomon. And when it mentions that he gave 3,000 of these, understand that the things that are mentioned here are not necessarily all included in our scriptures. Stitch in time, we'll save nine is not found in the book of Proverbs. Okay? It is a proverb, but it's not in our book of Proverbs. Rolling Stone gathers no moss, that's not there either. He spake 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Wow. How many do we have in the scripture that are Solomon's songs? Hint, 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 hint. One. It's called the Song of Solomon. But he wrote 1,005. But we have one. He also wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. I believe that when we get to that, I believe that was written at the end of his life, as he reassessed and looked back. So he was wise. He had these writings. It says, and he spake of trees from the cedar tree that is in Lebanon, even unto the hyssop, which springeth out of the wall. It was used for different things, ceremonial and everything, but it's a weed that would grow in between cracks in the pavement, that kind of thing. A big one might be knee high, a little bit higher than that, perhaps. But he speaks of all these things. He spake of the beasts and of the fowl and of the creeping things and of fish. And there came, here's the key thing I want you to look at. Verse 34. And there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon. From all kings of the earth, which had heard of his wisdom. And we'll see this with the Queen of Sheba in particular, as she's singled out. But she wasn't the only one. People came from all over the place to hear Solomon. And it isn't, I'm just perplexed. Where does snow come from? How does water get up there? It came down, it fell down here. How does it get back up there? Solomon had the answer. You know, different things that we take for granted. Where does this come from? How does this work? Where does, you know, and he knew. Either by observation or deduction, or maybe God just revealed it to him, but God, he knew. He was the, and understand that when God gave Israel the law, one of the things that was said, and ye shall be a kingdom of priests. You will be a people that mediates God to the world. Is what that idea means. I am giving you the scriptures. I have revealed myself to you, Israel, and you will take this to the world. And as you go through your Old Testament, how well did Israel do with that commission? Lousy. Was there any time in their history where they were fulfilling that purpose? Here. Which is why Solomon's fall is so tragic. Because for a window of time, Israel was fulfilling their God-given purpose. And people were coming from all over the known world to come to Solomon. Do you know where Sheba is? All right. The Arabian Peninsula is this box. Okay? Israel's over here. Here's the Arabian Peninsula. Persian Gulf over here. Red Sea here. At the bottom here is the present country of Yemen. That's Sheba. She came from all the way down there by caravan. All the way up here with questions for Solomon. Israel fulfilling their purpose. Israel is a light to the nations, and it's the only time in your entire Bible, in your entire Old Testament anyway, where Israel is fulfilling their God-given purpose. They will, again, it's prophesied in the Old Testament as well as the New. They will again. But in their long history, you got this little blip where they were doing it. Probably over a period of 2 or 3 decades. And that was it. Can you imagine? Of course, can you imagine what would happen if the church fulfilled their duty? All right, any questions or thoughts or anything on what we looked at so far tonight? The greatness, the magnificence of Solomon's reign. And this is just a summary. Fantastic people to run it. Hand-picked people. A huge amount of wealth. A vast amount of real estate that he controlled. Peace, prosperity, and wisdom. And understand that wisdom, you go back and read Proverbs. Wisdom is the knowledge of God. It isn't just information. It's the knowledge of God. And so you have a peace, prosperity, and wisdom. That is the thing that typified the bulk of Solomon's reign. A great, wonderful man that God raised up. What will he do with what God has given him? Well, we've seen some hints at some problems that will be coming up, and we'll be looking at that down the road. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you. Father, the wisest fallen man who has ever lived, failed. He was exalted. He had tremendous influence, tremendous opportunity. And for a window of time, he used it for your glory. But it was set aside for other things. Father, you have given us a greater legacy and a greater message. And with modern communication and so on, in so many ways, a greater opportunity. Father, may we seize the opportunity. May we fulfill our God-given purpose in this world, we pray for Christ's sake. Amen.